Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about Sidney Pollack's 1975 film, 3 Days of the Condor. With me, as always, is my good friend and roommate, Pat Miller. Pat, how's it going?
What up?
Also joining us is our trusty co-host, Tyler Brands. Tyler, what's happening?
Ahoy.
Ahoy, indeed. So, Tyler, it is your turn this week to pick a character for the character name game. If you're just listening to us for the first time, this is something we started a little while ago where we choose a character from a movie, a character's name, and then the remaining guests on the panel have to guess what movie that character is from. And then last week we actually installed a new kind of series of rules that states that the character has to be tangentially related in some way to a movie that came out the past, the Friday before. So in this case, that would be Friday, September 24th, since we're recording this on the 26th. So Tyler, what is your character for this week's character name game?
Well, I've been considering it for a couple days now, and I think I've got my blue card right here. I think the name I'm going to go with this week is Abigail Whistler.
Ooh.
Abigail Whistler.
I think I might know what this is, but that's
And you shouldn't give me the parameters because I go pretty obscure. I was about to go really obscure on the new rules that you put into place.
Okay.
I think I may have picked a pretty good character.
Okay, so for those of you listening in, be thinking about that, Abigail Whistler, and then we'll come to it at the very end of the episode and kind of answer it.
You think you know already?
I think I might, but I don't know. We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see.
If you say atonement, I'm going to slap you.
All right, so let's move on into the media consume section. This is the part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching on TV lately, any concerts we've been to, or just kind of events, special events and things of that sort. So, Pat, we always start with you. What have you been consuming lately?
I have been watching a lot of TV, almost to the point of I'm tired of watching TV. But, yeah, so it was, I guess, premiere week or whatever you want to call it. So I was just going to talk about – I watched almost every new premiere this week. That's a lie. But
you did not watch Mike and Molly on
you're
CBS.
You're correct. That was
really?
That was the one.
I thought for sure you guys would catch that.
But there's kind of four that I wanted to kind of touch on just briefly. So I'm going to start off with The Event on NBC. And I wasn't originally planning to watch this, but I think I was DVRing something else. So while that one DVR'd so I could skip the commercials, I was just like, okay, The Event is on. Why don't I watch that? And I did. And, for the first episode, understandably, it's heavy in the setup. Like, you're meeting the characters and kind of like the relationships that define them and, you know, how they're related to each other. I don't want to get into it too much, spoilers or anything, but, I guess I'll throw up kind of a spoiler alert right now where if you want to just skip forward a couple minutes. At the end of the event, okay, starting now, at the end of the event, there's the guy, one of the pilots who's also a character, is like crashing a plane. And so for the whole kind of episode, you're not really aware of any sort of supernatural happenings. It's just maybe like some secret undercover agency that connects all these people together. But the plane's about to like hit the president and his, I guess his house and his family down in Miami. The president's from Miami in this. And right before it does, just out of like alternate universe appears and the plane goes through it. And then that's the end of the episode. And I was like, what the hell? Like
I smoke lock.
Yeah, it kind of turned me off of the show. I was like, okay, I didn't realize I was watching one of these, like, where just random anything can happen. But that being said, I will still give it, I'll give it three more episodes before I make my ultimate, three or four before I make my ultimate verdict on The Event.
Wait, is that The Event? Was that the end, like,
I guess I mean I'm not entirely sure if the event refers to that because the way the show is structured is they'll do like flashbacks, multiple flashbacks, like within a flashback, so they'll go like 13 months ago or something, and then it'll go to like 2 weeks ago. With it'll go from 13 months ago to 2 weeks ago back to the present. So you go from like present to a year ago to 2 weeks ago to present, and you kind of alternate with that in characters. It might be some version of that. I don't know if 2 weeks comes before 13 months or
yeah,
but it got a little confusing in my head. So I'm not sure where the event takes place in that time period.
All right.
The next one real quickly is, we'll go with Outsourced. I did watch Outsourced. And before I had kind of checked it out, all of what I'd been hearing about it was, oh, this is going to be stupid, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, what I can say from what I watched is it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. It was pleasantly surprising.
This is a show on NBC, and it's about, like, the guy who moves to India, yeah. Right?
The guy is the head of a call center, and his whole wing... They sell like novelty goods or something, and his whole branch of the company is outsourced to India, but they keep him on because he's like the lead salesman, and they just kind of transfer him to India to, you know, lead the newly outsourced employees. Or
yeah,
I don't know what employees are called that are replacements,
like
for
local
the people.
Hires. Yeah.
So yeah, it wasn't like, I'll still check it out, and it has yet to, kind of
be canceled.
Yeah. I'll check it out till it's canceled, I guess. But
well, from all accounts, like in the beginning, it was supposed to be like this year's Cavemen. It was supposed to be just awful. So, yeah. I mean, I guess it's good to hear that it's not, really
it was
that
not,
bad.
It was not awful. I can say that. The next two shows I'm going to talk about. I kind of enjoyed, actually, Castle, which is not a new show, but it's a show, I think it's in its third season. It's a show that I've been meaning to watch, and I just haven't gotten in at the start of it. It's with Nathan Fillion, and I think the girl's name is, like, Stana Katic or something like that. I'm not going to do any sort of Eastern European pronunciation here. But I think they're really well together. I love Nathan Fillion. So he's kind of like his classic, like, rogue jokester self, like a humorous kind of troublemaker, I guess. So, you know, I love him in that. And the first episode was pretty great. And it's one that I'm going to try and stick around for this whole season. I'll eventually go back and watch the first two seasons.
I think the premise of that show is, like, he's a writer, he's like a
writer.
Novelist, and he follows around a cop to get ideas for stories or something.
Right, okay, yeah, cool. yeah.
Yeah, I saw one episode and liked it from what I saw. Yeah. I'm just kind of like you, like I missed it and never really got the chance to go back and catch up with it.
Yeah, it's one of those that I caught like episodes. I might have caught like two in the second season and one in the first, and I was like, oh, that's a decent show. But you know, I just missed the beginning episode, so I felt like I needed to go back.
Yeah.
The final show, which I also for some reason. Did not hear favorable things about was Undercovers on NBC. It's J.J. Abrams one. It's like a spy type structured drama. It's not really even a drama. Hour-long show, and it's about these two spies that used to work in the business and the CIA, I guess, and then they quit, and then they were asked back, blah, blah, blah. I didn't necessarily, I thought it exceeded my expectations, I guess is a good way to put it. You know, I thought it was going to be a little bit worse than it was, but it was better. And, it's J.J. Abrams is behind it. So, you know, I'll back J.J. Abrams on this one.
Yeah. I think it's like from the premise of it, it sounds like something that I would hate, to be honest. Like, it sounds like a bad Katherine Heigl movie. It's like, you know,
yeah.
Spy.
There are no bad Katherine Heigl movies.
Married couple spy comes out of retirement to, you know, or, you know, to like spice up their love life or whatever. And it's just like kind of an eye rolling.
Yeah.
Shay, you know, with movies like Mr. and Mrs. Smith and Killers and all these kind of, you know, there's been a night and day, and there's a lot of these kind of mismatched spy things going on in the past few years. But, yeah, it was done very, very well. And, I mean, like you said, Abrams actually directed the pilot. So, and, you know, it had that signature kind of style to it. And Ben Schwartz, who is like a secondary character, he's one of the guys that we see on a fairly regular basis at UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade here in Los Angeles, at these kind of improv shows that we go to, was really funny in it. I mean, he plays like, you know, the kind of Tom Arnold in True Lies character, like the guy in the van. But yeah, he did a great job. And the leads of the show, who I'd never heard before, I'm already kind of just like very charmed by them. That everybody did a really great job with the show. I'm kind of right there with you. This is one of my favorite shows so far of the new ones that we started. I guess I'll go ahead and talk just a little bit about Boardwalk Empire. This is one on HBO that's like, you know, being hailed as like the next Sopranos. It's supposed to be this absolutely epic, massive show for HBO. And it stars Steve Buscemi, and it's set in like the 1920s, in Atlantic City during Prohibition and all that. We caught the premiere last Sunday, and I'll give a little bit of a qualifier in that we watched it really late at night, so which I guess is a really terrible idea for us. We shouldn't do that because we tend to kind of drift off. But we watched it at like whatever freaking midnight or something, and it was like, it was good. I just wasn't necessarily completely sold on the fact that it was the savior of television that it was being hailed. So yeah. There's some solid acting. I mean, as to be expected from people like Steve Buscemi and Michael Shannon, who a lot of people don't really know him yet. He's not a household name, but he's been really awesome in everything I've seen him in. There's a bunch of potential for this show. I don't know how long. It's already been picked up for its second season. The premiere got such good ratings that they already, you know, picked it up. So it'll be around for a little while. And I think I'll give it a shot for kind of like you're saying for the event. I'll give it a shot for another 3 or 4 episodes to really see how interested I am in it. I'm not impugning its visual style or kind of overall look, because Martin Scorsese directed the pilot and it looks amazing. And the production design is really great, and Steve Buscemi's awesome, and like there's a lot of good elements to it. I just don't know if they'll be able to sustain a real show around that for 2 seasons, 3 seasons, 5 seasons, whatever. So
18 seasons.
I'll just kind of say that I wasn't as blown away with the premiere as other people were. I enjoyed it, but I'm not in love with it. One other one that I wanted to talk about was Lone Star. This I really enjoyed. Well, you missed the first, like the middle 20 minutes of it. Yeah, so that's kind of like outsourced for me part of that. So I can't really say
a third of the show, Pat.
What's that?
A third of the show.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So I really enjoyed Lone Star. It was it's on Fox, and it's about a guy who lives two lives as a con man, which, you know, any sort of con man scheme or you know, plot or whatever instantly has me intrigued. I'm kind of a sucker for heist movie, heist genre stuff and con men stuff. And I don't know, I really enjoyed it. It had like really good supporting performances from John Voight and this guy named David Keith, who starred in a made for TV television series called If Tomorrow Comes, based on a Sidney Sheldon novel back in the 80s, which is really good. If you get a chance to check that out, go for it. And the guy who stars in it, I don't even know his name. I've never seen him in anything before either, but he was really good and very charismatic as well. So, I mean, I don't know. I liked the show. And then immediately after it aired the next day or something, I was reading all of these reports about how Lone Star is dead in the water and it was in danger of being canceled after its first episode, not even being able to air its second episode, which like very, very rarely happens to narrative shows like that. I think the last time it happened was 5 years ago or something. And I was like, really? This is a good show. And the thing is, like, I'm not the only person who thinks it's good. There's, you know, after I watched it, I was kind of looking some stuff up about it, And apparently it's like kind of a hit within the critical community, which, you know, I'm not saying that that means it's good, but I liked it and I'm not the only person. So I don't know. I don't know why people didn't get a chance to watch it. Maybe it was the time slot it was in, up against Monday Night Football and the return of Dancing with the Stars and all this other crap that Middle America loves. But it's a shame if this show gets canceled. I heard that they are going to be able to air its second episode, so they're giving it kind of one last shot. I am guessing, if those reports are any indication, we won't be seeing much of Lone Star for very long, which is a shame in my opinion, because I really enjoyed it. So if you guys are listening to this before Lone Star's second episode airs on Monday night, September 27th, I believe, watch it, and, you know, maybe we can save the show.
Yeah, but, I'll continue to give it a shot.
So there's that one, and then the last one that I wanted to talk about was Hawaii Five-0, which is being adapted by Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman, who are the kind of teammates, kind of protege people, and they work with J.J. Abrams a lot. The three of them created Fringe. Kurtzman and Orci helped write Star Trek, the one that Abrams directed. They've been around a long time. They worked on some of your favorite shows, Tyler, the Xena and Hercules, I think. That's where they kind of got their start in the TV world. And they were responsible. They were producers on, like, Eagle Eye and a bunch of stuff. So they've been around for a while. They're kind of a big-name screenwriting duo. And they, you know, Hawaii Five-0 was a show before, obviously, and this is just kind of an update of it, a reimagining or whatever. And this is another one that, like, I really enjoyed. I wasn't expecting to like that much. Pat and I were talking about this a little, you know, after we actually watched it, and it's a procedural show. It's a cop drama, and there are definite elements to it that are very derivative and that we've seen hundreds of times before in all these other different kinds of shows. But it has the twist on it of being set in Hawaii, which, you know, I like a lot of those procedural shows if they have a twist on it. Like, I think that's why I like Castle, is because the plot elements are the same as something that you would see in another procedural show, but there's just that little extra something that makes it a bit more interesting. Same thing with Justified, you know, and Terriers, and like a lot of these kinds of cop shows and things like that. Dexter also, you know, they're procedural, but there's an element of freshness to them. And if the only element of freshness to Hawaii Five-0 is that it's set in Hawaii, I think that might be enough for me to keep watching it. The premiere was really great, and visually it looked cool. I mean, it's hard to make something look bad when it's set in Hawaii.
Yeah.
But the story was fine. Like, I didn't have any problems with it. And Scott Kahn, who we've been watching on this past season of Entourage, has really kind of raised his stock in my mind with his performance in this past season. And, you know, I don't know. I'm looking forward to see where the show goes. Also, it stars Daniel Day Kim, who played Jen on Lost. So there's a little bit of bias there in my favor for that. But yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the show. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I didn't like it as much as I thought I was going to. But, you know, first episodes, I'll give a little bit of leeway to. And it's one that I'll give a fair shake, definitely. And, I the Hawaii element in it is almost enough to just make me watch it anyways.
Yeah. So, Tyler, what have you been watching and or consuming lately?
Well, this week I've been catching all my regular shows. How I Met Your Mother was pretty solid. I liked that show.
Yep.
And it came back. I guess its season premiere was this week, and that was pretty good. And then It's Always Sunny came back and won me back over, because I didn't really like the premiere episode, but I really enjoyed the second episode.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully they can continue to do that with the rest of the season. I also caught the premiere of season 3 of Star Wars The Clone Wars. Everyone who knows me pretty much thinks that I think it's one of the greatest shows ever to come out of, like, the Star Wars franchise. And I know they don't have many shows, but like it's far superior than the prequel trilogy. Like, I just think it's one of the best written, like, best looking. And the first two episodes, actually, it was like an hour premiere, so the first half was focusing on a group of Stormtrooper clones and, like, telling their story. It was just, like, these obscure characters, these really obscure characters that no one had ever heard of that they just made up for this episode. And that was, like, really good episode. Like, they don't even need, like, the big players. They can make up Stormtroopers who all look the same and, you know, tell a story about just five guys and they're, you know, they're trying to pass this exam to get into the army.
Yeah.
And they really succeeded in, like, you know, telling a really good story. And then the second half had, like, the big characters like Kenobi and Skywalker, but they used the characters from that first episode like they were somehow involved. So it was pretty good. This week's episode was actually kind of 50-50 because, again, it dealt with, like, minor characters, but it deals with a lot of, like, military government issues, too. Like, it's supposed to be a kid's show, but it deals with, like, you know, how governments work and how, like, treaties can be betrayed and, you know, basic warfare technology and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's not just for kids, and people shouldn't just brush it off because it's on Cartoon Network, because it's a really solid show.
It takes place during the second and episode two and episode three. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I really don't like that because it does set the parameters for what can happen in the show because, you know, General Grievous is a major character in the show, but we know he dies in episode three. So obviously he's not going to die in the show.
Yeah.
The same goes for, like, Dooku. He's in the show, but he dies in episode three. So he's obviously not going to die in the show. But they can create, like, other villains that exist within the show. That way they can't die or they can, you know, get away with stuff. Of course, all the main characters make it into the next movie, so we know they're not going to die, even though they try to, you know, use dramatic, like, they're tied up and they're about to be killed. Yeah. But you're like, well, they're not going to die because they make it into the next movie.
Yeah.
And, of course, like, it's not going to be, like, discontinuous with anything because that's one of those franchises that make sure that all the fans are happy. Like, they can't step out of bounds in any way. They can't, like, alter the movies.
Yeah.
So you can count on, like, Yoda being around and all these characters. So,
yeah, I mean,
pretty solid stuff.
Say what you will about George Lucas, but the man created, like, one of the most vast storytelling universes that the cinematic or film or TV world has ever known. Like, like you were saying, where you don't even have to have the major players. I'll give him that credit at least, where he created a world where you can make a random Stormtrooper story just as interesting. So,
right.
And yeah, you and I saw the Clone Wars movie when it came out, and I was like,
oh hell yeah!
You know, I was like, okay, this actually wasn't bad. You know, I wrote it off because it was animated, and that was a mistake on my part. So I haven't really given the show a shot. I just been too busy. But yeah, I can definitely speak to the fact that just because it's animated doesn't mean that you should write it off. So
yeah, people assume that movie was going to do terrible. And I mean, I don't know what its ratings were in the box office, but it was basically just a movie in theater. So people would go see it to get established for this show that came out like that fall.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's not a bad marketing plan considering you have the money to do that, to produce a show/movie.
Yeah.
You know, because it has, like, billions of dollars with this franchise. It's not like it's a struggling franchise.
Have you heard any updates about the live-action Star Wars TV show that they've been...
The last update I heard was, like, they were hiring writers, and that was when I had written an article in the Sentinel about who they should hire.
Oh, okay.
That's all I've ever heard about it so far.
Yeah.
I think they're in, like, Australia or something filming, if they do have started filming.
Right on.
But the other thing I saw this week, it was on Geek Tyrant, and I'm sure if you type it in the search bar, you'll find it. It's a Pokemon fan-made trailer, and I guess there was like a 3-second or 5-second, 10-second clip of this trailer like a couple weeks ago. At least that's what the article said. I don't know who wrote the article.
Okay.
I'll say Venkman.
Yeah, probably a good guess.
So I was like, oh, wow, I guess, you know, because I've seen a lot of fan-made stuff, and usually it's just, like, Photoshopped pictures, like, flashing across the screen. But this was, like, an actual trailer. This was, like, they wanted to make it, like, a gritty feel, like a Nolan universe kind of thing, where they revamped everything, and all the characters were real dark and brooding, and all the Pokemon were, like, computer-animated, and it was really sweet. And you're just going to have to check it out for yourself. I mean, if you watched the show in the 90s when I was a kid or when we were kids, then you're going to like this trailer. I mean, it's not for people that like the series or the franchise now because It's nothing like what it is now. Like, it's a completely different. What I see is, if this movie's gonna be made, it's gonna have to be made like 30 years in the future, when Pokemon is like a nostalgic thing. It's like when they went back and redid like G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
It's like that.
Okay.
Like it's like a nostalgia movie trailer, but it there's no nostalgia yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted, because a lot of the comments were really funny on the YouTube page, so I'm gonna read a couple. I have four here. If I'm allowed to.
Yeah, I mean, YouTube comments are generally widely recognized as being some of the worst places in human existence for just, like, you know, unbearable language, and just, like, the absolute dregs of society rise to the top and comment on YouTube videos. So.
Well, the Geek Tyrant comment section was pretty bad, too. Like, people were saying how shoddy the animation was, and I was like, what are you talking about? So I went straight to the source, the YouTube comments, and I wanted to see what the consensus was. Okay, here's one. Here's I don't have any names, but YouTube commenter number one said, this can't be a movie because, number one, this is most likely to be an R-rated for a kids series, so obviously no one's gonna go see it. I guess that's what he's trying to say.
Okay.
And number two, too much violence for a kids series. Thumbs up if you agree, but nice job. Okay, that guy's obviously a moron. Okay. The next comment, Pokemon plus Sin City equals too much for my taste. Now, obviously, if we were writing this, we would have said Pokemon plus Sin City equals effing awesome, but this guy would be too much for his taste. All right, commenter number three said, I thought they saw the lesson in Dragon Ball Z EVO. I guess that was the movie.
I think it was.
This is the biggest Shiite I've ever seen. I'm not too much of an Asian myself, but Western movies hate Eastern animations. I thought that one was pretty racist. And then, okay, the final one, all in caps, on my daughter's life, if I ever find out who made this, instantly stab to the heart.
I like how they bring their daughter into it.
Yeah. Apparently somebody didn't like it as much. But, check it out. See what you have to say for yourself. Email us your own YouTube comments if you were commenting on YouTube. Do all that stuff, because I thought that was really funny. And a really good trailer.
If you do choose to email us your YouTube comments, make it as confusing as possible, and don't tell us what YouTube video you're commenting on. Just leave the comment in our email inbox, and then leave it up to us to decipher what you're talking about.
Yeah, it'll be a new segment where the NJ Not Just New Movies podcast group try to interpret your YouTube comment.
We only have to guess from, like, 9 billion YouTube videos which one it came from, so...
But yeah, hats off to the guys that made this trailer, because once you see it, you'll see how much work goes into like 2 minutes and 20 seconds of footage. You can just, because we've made trailers before too.
Yeah.
And they take an entire day to get like a 3-minute trailer.
Yeah.
This is obviously, from the look of it, it looks like it's taken a year, 2 years maybe.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I never played Pokemon or didn't know anything about it. I completely skipped that part of the 90s and in general. So I don't know how much I'll get out of it, but I'll give it a whirl.
Yeah, it's 2 minutes, Ben.
Yeah, I can probably spare that.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go ahead and move on into our review of 3 Days of the Condor.
This is a major.
This is Joe Turner.
Identification?
My name is Turner. I work for you. Now listen.
Identify yourself.
What is your designation?
Condor.
Something has happened. Section 9, Department 17.
The section's been hit.
What level?
What level?
Level of damage.
Everybody. Dr. Lapp, Janice, Ray, Harold. Everybody is dead.
What is it?
What is it?
Are you damaged?
Damaged? No.
Are you armed? Identify the armament.
It's a .45 automatic. Will you guys bring me in, please? I'm not a field agent. I just read books.
Oh yeah, I forgot we were viewing a movie.
Yeah, the media consume section has been remarkably long this week. But what did you guys think about 3 Days of the Condor? Pat, what did you think?
I enjoyed it, I guess. It was kind of, you know, nothing special. Maybe a little long-winded, I guess. There was quite a few, what's the word I'm looking for?
Dialogue.
Exposition. There was a lot of dialogue, I guess. I guess to me, sometimes Robert Redford's character would just kind of do things and say things that I did not expect him to say, or just things would happen. Like, the whole... If we're just getting into specifics here, the whole elevator scene, where, like, clearly Robert Redford is in kind of a period of him being suspicious of people, and here's a guy dressed in, like, a trench coat and a hat who's just, like, following him randomly, and he just, like, gets on the elevator with him, and then he doesn't make any sort of effort to get off the elevator when it's him... Just those two alone on the elevator. I don't know. It was, but it's not a bad movie, though, is the thing. Like, I was kind of reminded of another Robert Redford spy movie, Spy Game.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like that one a lot better. Not that we're going to go into reviewing that, but, yeah, I, you know, whatever. It's not bad, but it's not, it's just, like, kind of middle of the road, leaning towards, like, the good side, I would say, like, B minus.
Okay.
In that range.
All right, Tyler, how about you?
I think it was pretty good. I really like movies like this, especially I like the niches movies fall into, and this one falls into like 70s conspiracy movies, I guess. I'm gonna create that genre right now.
Sure.
And it started out like it was gonna be kind of I don't know, it wasn't as doom and gloom at the beginning. But then it eventually did turn into like a conspiracy movie, like a suspense movie. I really liked what they did with that. I also, he kind of had a character change right away too. He kind of like got shocked into this situation, because at the beginning you see him like cruising on his motor bicycle and he's like goofing around and he's cracking jokes in the office. But then all of a sudden he comes back from lunch and he's like super serious. He doesn't, you know, he's not messing around anymore. I thought that was a really awkward character switch, but I guess, you know, you get the adrenaline pumping from a situation, you know, maybe you stop joking around. I don't know when to stop, so it's obvious maybe some people know when to stop joking around.
I don't know, maybe, but if your girlfriend was murdered in your office, then you might stop joking.
But I thought it was interesting that the movie was based on a book called 6 Days of the Condor as opposed to the 3 Days of the Condor. So I guess in the book, this movie takes place over the course of 6 days instead of just three.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I'm a political scientist, so I've studied, like, government entities and agencies and stuff. And so to see that story where you kind of see, like, these agencies messing with people, kind of, and you start to wonder, oh, do they really do that? Does that stuff really go on? Do people just get wiped out? And you start to wonder whether this really happens to people, whether government agencies wipe out their employees once they're, you know, unnecessary. But... yeah, you have to watch the whole movie because you're not going to understand it right away. Like, the clues and the actual storyline kind of unravels through the course of the film. And I know, Ben, I said this before the podcast started, it was kind of reminiscent of The Conversation, which we can talk about a little bit later.
Yeah.
But that was also, I don't think that was, I can't remember, I haven't seen it in a couple of years, but I don't think that was like CIA government stuff. I think that was more of like maybe smaller government stuff. But it had the same feel, like the music, the grittiness of the city, like the film grain and like the character interaction. Yeah, Pat, there was a lot of dialogue, but it was like well-delivered dialogue.
Where
it pertained to the story, or it pertained to the characters' relationships. So I thought overall the movie was pretty good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. I think as something that you mentioned, Tyler, about like how it doesn't exactly tell you what's going on right in the beginning. You do have to kind of watch the whole thing and have it come back to you and explain what was happening. At first I was like, I'm not entirely clear what's going on here. And I didn't know if it was just because I wasn't getting it. Like, if I was being stupid or something and missed key parts, or if the movie just expected me to fill in the gaps on my own. But it did, you know, as the movie goes on, about halfway through, there's a scene where Robert Redford like sits down and kind of maps out what he knows so far and goes through this kind of series of flashbacks of what he's heard and things like that. And that kind of sets the pieces in place for what's happened and kind of gives you a little bit of a compass point as far as where the movie's going and where it's come from so far. So I enjoyed the structure of it. I thought the writing was really good. And just the concept of alone, you know, of a guy who Yeah, he's a CIA agent, but this could have happened. He plays almost an everyman. You know, he says multiple times, like, I'm not a field agent. I just read books. This isn't the guy who's been trained to, you know, in weapons training and all that stuff. You know, he's very, like, bookish. He's kind of just like a nerd. Like, basically his job is just to pile through books and comic strips and all these kinds of adventure stories, pulp novels and things, just looking for codes to see if they're being translated into certain languages.
To get ideas from those stories.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really cool.
Yeah, and like that's, you know, that was one of my favorite parts is like early on he walks in and a couple of his coworkers are talking about how a certain murder scene played out or whatever, and Redford walks in and instantly is like, oh, it's just an ice bullet, and they're like, what are you talking about? And he kind of explains this thing about that he read it in like a Dick Tracy story or something, where a criminal like freezes, you know, makes a mold of a bullet, puts water in it, freezes it, and then shoots somebody, and then that way the bullet just melts away in their body and there's no trace of anything. Just that whole concept alone of that kind of work actually being done is kind of cool and intriguing to me. And then add to the fact that he's playing this kind of everyman who, yeah, like you said, goes to lunch and comes back and everybody's murdered. Like, it's very easy for us as the audience to put ourselves in that situation because, you know, anybody who's worked in an office knows kind of what that dynamic is like and things like that. And it can very easily just put yourself in there and be like, oh, wow, what would I do? And it's a lot easier to relate to him because he doesn't have the success. He's not Jason Bourne. He doesn't have excessive weapons training or anything. So,
yeah. Well, that was the other thing I thought of was like comparing it to the Bourne series, because that sort of unraveling experience where as you watch the film, you get to know a little bit more and more about the character and the character situation and what the government's trying to do. I thought there was some major similarities as far as like that kind of movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to say was what you said, how you didn't know what was going on until like later into the film, like you got a little bit every scene. I think that was the filmmaker's way of getting you more closely linked with the main character, because he's learning the same things you are. He's kind of like a blank slate at the beginning of the film too. You know, he's trying to find out what the government's doing, just like the audience is. He doesn't know why this is happening, neither does the audience.
Sure.
So it's kind of like the filmmaker's way of getting you connected or put you into the movie.
Yeah. What did you guys think about Robert Redford?
I thought he was good. I mean, I think I liked the first half of the movie a lot more than the second half. I think, Tyler, you might have touched on like there being some sort of switch somewhere along there. I don't know what it was for me, and it wasn't Robert Redford, because I liked him pretty much the whole time. Like when he was, I'm not sure where he was, but he's in some sort of phone routing room.
Yeah.
And he was kind of, you know,
that part was really sweet.
Yeah, trying to like hide where so they couldn't trace him, and he, you know, plugged all these wires in. So I you know, that's later in the movie, and I still liked it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't think it was Robert Redford. I think it's just for me the action didn't pick up enough at like the point where it should have. It kept just kind of like coming back down with like the Faye Dunaway part of the story. Like he was, I guess she tries to like keep him grounded. That's like kind of his grounded back to like this is reality. And so every time he kept coming back down, I just kind of could feel that, like, it just kept coming back down for me. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, blah, blah, blah. This is, you know, real life, not a movie or something.
Yeah. Like the sense of danger and stuff went away whenever she was there.
Yeah. And I guess that's what makes this movie different is, like, in another movie, you know, crazy explosions or something might happen to make it less similar to real life, whereas this movie I guess tried to make it more similar to real life, and that's not a bad thing. I don't know, I wasn't expecting it, I guess.
Tyler, what'd you think about Redford?
He was pretty good. I like him pretty much in anything. He always plays like the grizzled, or I guess when he got older he played the grizzled, like, you know, but lovable character, you know, the manly man, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like I said at the beginning, he was real dorky, but then once all this stuff started happening, he became like he knew exactly what he was doing because he read all this stuff.
Yeah.
Which I kind of find to be a little outrageous. But at the same time, it's like, well, he does do it for a living, so maybe he does actually pick up stuff, you know.
Well, if he worked in
the CIA.
Yeah, if he worked in a library or something like that and then went and did these things, then I would kind of call BS on it and say that it's ridiculous. But the thing is, he's reading all of these like spy stories and like adventure stories and pulp novels and mystery things and all that. So he definitely has a base of knowledge in those kinds of elements. So I think that's why he stays alive, you know, for the movie, is because of that kind of knowledge. Like that's where he his knowledge, you know, his experience comes in, not in the
right.
weapons or you know, stunt driving or whatever. It's just like
right.
you know, his kind of wit and research based knowledge and stuff comes into play and helps save him in the end.
Yeah, I like that he wanted to know exactly what happened and why it was happening, because he had submitted the report that there was something wrong in the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they were coming after him, is because he was pulling the wrong thread.
Yeah.
And so it was just kind of cool, like a cool character to just, you know, he wants to go to the, he doesn't care, you know, who gets shot or whatever. And, you know, he tries to save as many people as he can, but his main goal is to try to see what's going on in the CIA.
Yeah.
You know, he actually infiltrates their office in New York City, you
yeah.
know, sends Faye Dunaway in to like get this guy to show up.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was really just like a all around badass character.
Yeah, I think that was the one thing that I didn't necessarily care for, is like how long it took him to figure out that it was his own work that was causing all of this.
Right.
Like I don't know, maybe it's just because I've seen a lot of movies that kind of peripherally deal with the same thing, but it's like, you know, you walk in, everybody's murdered. That very day, you were handed back a questionable report from your kind of overlords,
yeah.
like writing off something that you consider a legitimate prospect.
Right.
And you still have a lot of questions about, and you are the only person who has uncovered this. And then all of a sudden, like, coincidentally, everybody gets murdered that day, and and he can't, like, he doesn't instantly put the pieces together that, oh, it's probably this thing that I'm working on that I'm hit.
Right.
It's like, I don't know, it just seems like maybe there's a little bit of naivete, if that's how you say that,
right.
in there in the beginning, where he's like, oh, it can't possibly be my own government that's behind this, because
yeah.
we're the good guys and blah, blah, blah. But then
exactly. I think that's, yeah.
It takes a very cynical turn at the end, especially at the end, because it gets into this whole, like, James Bond scenario where he, like, confronts the villain and, like, he just lays out all this stuff about what's been going on and what's happening and stuff, and, you know, how the whole thing is basically just about oil, and there's this very cynical look at the world. And I think, you know, we have to take into account that this was made in 1975. This is, like, in the shadow of Vietnam, and like the way the country was thinking back then was actually
oil crisis
not,
too.
Well, yeah, I mean, what's that?
The oil crisis was in the 70s too.
Sure, yeah. So I mean, I was gonna say the way the country was thinking back then is totally different, but it's actually not that dissimilar to the
no.
way it's operating right now. But you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, we could have said it was wildly different than, you know, in the late 90s or something. But yeah, with all just the kind of general distrust of the government that's added on at the very end of the movie, when all of these things kind of come to light, and especially the very, very end where it's like
yeah.
he, Redford, whatever, compiles all this evidence and kind of sends it off to the New York Times, and then he like kind of drops that as his final card, like, booyah, I just sent this stuff to the New York Times,
right.
like, I just blew the lid off this whole operation, and then he's so confident that, like, everything's going to work out in his favor, or at least, like, exposing the public to what he's learned. And then his operative guy is like, what makes you so sure that they're going to publish it? Like,
yeah.
And he's like, oh, they're going to publish it. And he's like,
yeah.
But are they really? You know, and it's just,
yeah.
like, oh, you know, snappy one-liners, and you can have all the confidence in the world, but the serious way that they delivered that last segment of the film kind of puts that element into question, where you're like, maybe this isn't going to work out the best way. Maybe the corruption goes all the way to the level of the press and the media and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it definitely starts out with this kind of easygoing vibe and then turns into something that makes you think a little bit, which I think is characteristic of a lot of the films that came out of the 70s.
Yeah, it was like an eerie ending where you're like, oh, God, maybe they do have a hand in what the Times puts out, you know?
Yeah.
Because it was the CIA that did this to him initially. You know, how much control do they really have?
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like a scary, a scary thought that, you know, no matter what you do, there's going to be somebody watching you, you know, blah, blah, blah. Whatever.
Yeah.
That's what made me think of the conversation, because the conversation ended just as eerily at the very end, because he realized, I don't want to give too much of the conversation away, but he finds out at the very end what he's been working towards the entire movie, and he finds out exactly what.
Yeah, don't say anything about it. Don't say anything.
Yeah, I'm not, but he does find out at the end, and it's kind of one of those eerie endings where you're like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
It's one of those shocking, not shocking endings, like, you know, the kid was dead the whole time or whatever, but one of those.
Yeah.
What did you think was so conversation-esque? Was it just kind of the feel of the movie, or did you see some nuances like in the storyline?
No, not necessarily. Just the vibe of it. And, like, you know, I think this came out in 75, and I want to say the conversation came out in 74, you know, kind of in that same range. And they just kind of shared a lot of the look and the kind of using the city as a backdrop and stuff. Like, kind of things that you had already said, basically, just like the camera, the cinematography, the style and stuff, and the music and everything. Yeah, it just kind of, it was an interesting time in filmmaking, that's for sure.
Right?
These looked the same, even though they had different plot lines and stuff. But, I mean, I guess you can still say that of something like today, too. A lot of the, you know, the romantic comedy genre or something is like all of them are shot and lit in the exact same way. Jerry Bruckheimer action movies are all shot and lit the exact same way. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of similarities there that you could draw to films of today as well. But just like that particular style is very, reminiscent of the 70s, obviously. But
oh, yeah.
There was a couple things that I wanted to bring up real quick is in the way of individual scenes. The sex scene with the pictures, like where the montage, I'd never seen anything like that before. That was kind of,
it was another awkward love scene.
Yeah. And then the blaring saxophone in the background, just like accentuating everything that was going on.
I just didn't like how she had like a blood stare every time she was aroused. Like she would just jerk her head to the side and like stare right at the camera. And you're like, is she possessed?
Yeah,
you know, she's possessed by Redford, but a demon is a demon involved now?
Yeah, I don't know. Faye Dunaway, I don't know.
She didn't smile once in this movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen her in much, but yeah, I don't really know how much I liked her performance or didn't like it. She seemed almost like she had this kind of weird fetish or something. Like, you know, she liked being tied up by Robert Redford, and she enjoyed playing that role of like the captor or the captivated or whatever, the captured,
captive.
I don't know.
Yeah, I liked how she had a weird character shift too, because she was like all shaken up until the part where he asked her to help him. And then all of a sudden she's like calm as a cucumber and like throwing lines at the CIA head. Like he's like, yeah, you better leave because he's got a gun, you know, just like really calm when a couple scenes prior, she like freaked out because the mailman was dead.
Yeah.
So, but I liked her. She was adequate, I guess, for this type of role. It was a government movie. It wasn't a romance.
Sure.
Hey, let's look at the pretty girls movie.
Yeah, and I like the fact that they didn't really concentrate. Well, you know, she was with some guy, and she was supposed to be meeting him in Vermont, and then at the end, she just goes to Vermont and meets the guy.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't do this stupid thing where, like, she's trying to hang out with Redford all the way through or whatever. She just, like, goes off, you know, they do their thing, and then she goes off the distance, which is fine. Like, I appreciate it when movies don't try to test the limits of realism as far as relationships go.
She was probably killed on the train.
But one thing that I really found very humorous was the karate kicking postman in that. Like, I liked how his main
terrible.
His main like, weapon of choice was his foot. Like, he just, like, flying drop kicks into Redford and, like, smashing into furniture. And instead of punching, like, any normal person, right. this guy was doing, like, and he was kind of a tubby guy. So he was doing, like, yeah. slow spin kicks and just, like, kicks that seemed very difficult for him to pull off, and
right.
no, that was his primary method of attack was kicking.
Yeah. Did you like those sound effects where every time someone got hit, it was like an exhaust of air? Oof. It was the same sound effect. Oof.
What else? There was one other thing. Yeah, you guys had already talked about, like, the hooking into the phone line sequence where, like, you know, he's in that room. And it was almost like that was the internet for the 70s. Like,
yeah.
he was
yeah.
just, like, he was doing all this manual research there, and that was, like, his Google was, like, calling people
yeah.
manually and then, like, going through and finding all this stuff out, where now, you know, people would just type it into a computer. He had to actually, like, physically call these people and, like, fake things and just try to get his information that way.
Program and then plays back the dial
yeah,
the number
yeah.
the dial numbers and it gives him the number.
Yeah, exactly.
ridiculous.
Yeah. And then
but plausible now.
Yeah. And then, like, the one other thing that is, like, a really kind of interesting thing that this movie does that I haven't seen that often, where it, at the very end, it kind of gives you a look into the mindset, the ethos of a hitman. Like, he talks to Max von Sydow's character, or Sydow, plays this kind of mercenary, you know, free-for-all man of whatever, or whatever the term is for that. And he has this conversation with Redford at the end where it's like, you know, he's talking about being a freelance mercenary. It's like, you don't have to believe in either side. It's, he says something like, all the belief you have to have is in your own precision. And it's like, that's the... You know, you very rarely get a look into the thought process of what a hitman does. They're always just kind of this Anton Chigurh character in No Country for Old Men, where there's just kind of this force that's following the protagonist around, like, trying to kill them, or that the protagonist is hunting, or whatever the scenario may be. But it's kind of rare that you get the you know, somebody, that conversation scene where they're actually talking about what they think about the work that they do. I don't know, I just thought that was kind of interesting.
I thought the good line was, don't ask who or why, just how much.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I thought that was really sweet. Spin-off.
Yeah.
The German. The Alsace-Lorraine.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't really have much else to say about it, and if you guys just want to give maybe closing thoughts or something, or bring up any other thing that we haven't mentioned yet.
I'll give closing thoughts. I guess, you know, it's an above average movie that, you know, I can recommend to see. It's just nothing overly spectacular, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, closing thoughts here. I guess I'm not going to open up any more stuff. I think we covered a lot of it. Yeah, it's a pretty good movie. I enjoyed it. And if you haven't seen a movie in the 1970s conspiracy movie genre, this would be one of those. So check it out.
Yeah, and we should also encourage people to see The Conversation.
Yeah, see The Conversation, too.
And Spy Game.
Yes, and Spy Game. Conversation is directed by Francis Ford Coppola, and I think it's 1974. And Spy Game, I believe, was directed by Tony Scott, and it stars Robert Redford and Brad Pitt.
Oh, yeah. Tony Scott.
In, like, 2002 or 2001 or something. So
3 Days of the Thunder.
Days of Thunder. That's a reference to our most recent podcast. Took me a second there. Okay, cool. Well, Tyler, how about revving up the old Apple II and letting us know what we're going to watch next week?
Oh, Ben, Pat, I have a big announcement for you guys.
All right.
I've recently installed a huge switch on the side of the Apple II
mm-hmm.
that switches it from regular to Halloween mode.
Ooh,
nice.
Yeah, right? So all the movies that I'm setting some parameters now. So in any movie that, you know, Halloween or horror themed. Is up for grabs.
Okay, because that makes sense. I mean, the next podcast we do will be on October 3rd.
Yeah.
So
we're going to have 4 solid shows of horror / Halloween / you know, cut 'em up movies, hopefully.
All right.
All right, let me start it up.
Oh, Halloween mode.
Right? Halloween mode's pretty badass, right, guys?
Yeah. Yep. What do we got?
We got Jeff Goldblum's The Fly, not directed by Jeff Goldblum, but he's in it, from 1986.
Okay.
It's a short 95-minute flick that concerns the remake of the 1958 The Fly.
All right, excellent.
I think Vincent Price was in the original, but Jeff Goldblum is in this one.
Okay, good stuff. Well, yeah, I believe that's available on Netflix Watch Instant, so if you guys want, you can watch along and then listen in next week for our thoughts on The Fly. I believe this is directed by David Cronenberg.
That's true, Ben.
Yeah, so you can email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of this episode, any prior episode, or The Fly, so we can read your email on the air next week. We didn't get any email this week, so we'll just go ahead and skip that part. So let's move on.
Buzzkill.
Yeah, let's move on and
get
go
it,
ahead.
Buzzkill.
And what? Oh, buzz, the fly buzz. Yeah, I gotcha. Okay. Boo.
Waka waka.
Let's go ahead and finish up the character name game. So Tyler, remind us again what the character's name was.
Yes, character name game. This week's name is Abigail Whistler.
So
Abigail Whistler, and it has to do with something that came out this past Friday, the new release in theaters.
Yes.
Even though we usually do one that's not currently in theaters.
Right.
But those are the parameter settings. So
Pat, do you have any guesses? Because I'm almost 100% sure that I know this.
I'm just going to go with the first one that came that popped in my head, and that's Eagle Eye.
That is incorrect.
Okay. All right, so here we go, Tyler. You ready for this? Blade
No.
Trinity.
Oh, yes.
I'm pretty sure that was Jessica Biel's character. The name Whistler just stuck out
to me.
That's
the old man in the Blade trilogy. I knew that was going to be a telltale red flag.
Yeah.
Can you make the connection?
Well, obviously, the connection is in Blade Trinity, Jessica Biel co-stars with Ryan Reynolds, who recently
almost there.
Opened the movie Buried in limited release
last
week.
There you go. Reached your destination.
Yes, and Buried is actually a very interesting movie directed by Rodrigo Cortez. I would recommend checking out. I think it opens wide on October 8th. So that's about as much as we'll get into movies that are currently or upcoming in theaters. But yeah, cool. So good stuff. You guys can feel free to subscribe to us on iTunes. We're free. I mean, it doesn't take anything to do that. Also, please, if you could, leave us a review in iTunes. It kind of helps our visibility and things like that. You can check us out on Facebook. Just type the Not Just New Movies podcast into the search bar up top, and you'll track us down there. Why don't we go around the circle and just tell everybody where they can find more of our work on the internet. Pat, we'll start with you.
You can still find me at the-life-after.blogspot.com.
Good stuff. Tyler?
Have you updated that recently, Pat?
No. But I am working on...
I'm typing it in now.
I just took a trip to San Francisco a little while ago, so I'm working on a little mini Life After short. So look for that in the upcoming weeks.
Yeah, you need more to use that intro on.
Yep.
Tyler, how about you? Where can people track you down this week?
You got me at the Solar Sentinel. You got me at Dest Again. And I'm also trying to make a comeback at Geek Tyrant. This week I posted a blurb or whatever you want to call it on the Angry Video Game Nerd announcing an Angry Video Game Nerd movie.
Wow. Okay.
And he wants to push it through like the indie, what are those little festivals? He wants to put it through like the small movie festivals when it's made. And I address like what the nerd wants to do with the character. Like a lot of people give him a rough time because he's like only putting out one a month now.
Yeah.
But it's only because he's like being burned out on this stuff.
Yeah.
And that he has no room to do anything else. And that this was kind of a reason why he's been pulling in the reins a little is because he's trying to make a movie.
Give people like a 2-sentence summary of what the Angry Video Game Nerd or who he is in case they're not familiar.
He's an outrageously vulgar video game reviewer, and the video games are only from the past. He doesn't review, like, new video games. It's basically classic vintage video games like Atari, Nintendo Entertainment System, Sega. I think the farthest he's gone is up to, like, the N64, but that's only because the games were involved in, like, an omnibus.
Okay.
So he did, like, all the games in the series, but mostly he sticks to, like, Sega and before, like Super Nintendo, sometimes he'll do Game Boy, but it's basically, vintage video games, and they have to be terrible. They're not good games. They're terrible games. So he gives them a real tongue lashing, and he sometimes, if you go and you watch like some of his older ones, like 2006, 2007, he tries to make them like movies, like little short movies. Mm-hmm. And so you see the video game review, but then there's all this other stuff going on outside of the review.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically part of the episode, which I think is pretty cool. You know, it's not just like what I do on the Sentinel where I just straight review something. He has a review within a bigger story.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he was talking about with what the movie would be like. It would be like a Wayne's World movie where, yeah, there's the Wayne's World show, but then there's also this whole universe of things that happen to the characters that have the show.
Gotcha.
So he's trying to do like a, you know, angry video game nerd in the world of, you know, in his world, as opposed to him just reviewing video games.
Nice. Yeah, I know. We've been talking just amongst ourselves about maybe trying to get him on for one of the episodes here. So hopefully we can try to make that happen. We'll see what happens. So stay tuned.
Pretty sure he listens to us and that he's just been waiting for us to invite him over.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure about that.
But yeah, I mean, if you're interested, folks that are listening, check him out at cinemassacre.com.
Cool. All right. So you guys can track me down at Twitter. What's that?
I'm not an ass kisser, though.
Oh, okay. So you guys can track me down at twitter.com/BenPears. That's BenPears. Writing kind of sporadically, unfortunately, at Geek Tyrant. I'm writing a bunch of reviews right now for Filmonic.com and NotJustNewMovies.com, which is the home of this podcast. And you can find Pat and I on the Geek Tyrant Weekly podcast. You can track that down in iTunes as well. Music for our show is provided by George Turner and the Bandits. You can find their music at gtbandits.com, and they're also on Twitter and Facebook, so check them out there. I think that'll pretty much wrap it up for this week, so thanks for listening, guys. Feel free to check out The Fly from 1986, and listen in, write us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. Listen in next week, and we will talk to you guys then. Money that